Blog Talk Radio.
Have you ever wondered why it's happening again?
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife, Jeannie. Michael and Jeannie share with you the wisdom of the ancient Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. They offer tools and support 5 days a week. They will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love. In Aramaic, Rachma. Michael is the author of Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.whyagain.com. And now your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice.
To the brightness within you and the truth that is rooted within me.
Hi, and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host, and we welcome you to the show. Today is Aramaic Friday, October 24th, 2014. Our call-in number is 646-200-4169. And press 1, and that puts you in queue to talk to us. And we would love to hear your comments and your questions because that makes this your show. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, dear heart. We have an absolutely beautiful day, a little cloudy, but we're in October in Michigan, the middle of October, and it's still probably about, 60 degrees or so, so pretty nice. And we're getting ready to finish up the last of our workshops at Renaissance Unity here in Lansing, although we have added 3 additional events over the period of the next 3 days or 4 days. On Sunday, we'll be at Unity of Greater Lansing doing the Sunday service at 10:30, and then in the afternoon from 12:30 until 3:30, we'll be doing a 3-hour codependence to interdependence. And then Monday night, we'll be moving to another location. We'll be at the fellowship for today, 7 to 9 o'clock, doing the lesson, What is the World? From A Course in Miracles. And then on Tuesday, we'll be down on the south side of the town at the IM Center doing Why Is This Happening to Me Again from 7 to 9:30. So we've got lots on our plate. We're going to get a couple of days off when we finish that and then head on down to Pinckney, Michigan, where we'll start a 9-day codependence to interdependence intensive. And we'll just be cranking the energy up to the next level, looking forward to being there. We have this absolutely beautiful facility. The weather heading into it is looking pretty nice. Looks like it's going to be up into the 70s this weekend. We still have these awesome, beautiful yellows and greens and golds and reds and just fabulous fall colors. So looking forward to that, hanging around that, that we'll hold the space that we keep the weather fairly calm so the leaves do stay on the trees, but right now it's absolutely beautiful. And so we're delighted that you're here, and what I thought I'd talk about today is a little bit about the creative process and just how it is that we create our lives. And, you know, came to the ancient Aramaic when they spoke to this man, Yeshua, the physicist, the psychologist, the geneticist, the physiologist. And they asked him, you know, what's most important in this whole thing called the law? The way the Greeks translate, you know, when you mistranslate something, you miss the meaning of words, it gets really difficult to apply in any way, shape, or form what was said. And so there's been hundreds and hundreds of years of misapplication of just this one simple idea. And what we're told by the Greeks is that you're supposed to love the Creator and you're supposed to love your neighbor and you're supposed to love your neighbor just like you love yourself. Well, unfortunately, most of the world is doing exactly that, and because there's so much self-hatred, there's plenty of hatred of neighbors, and that's why on planet Earth we've murdered in excess of 150 million people and more in the last 75 years. Like, how insane is that? And, you know, people who supposedly have relationship with the Creator, which is love, And Yeshua, who said, love those who hate you and do good to those who despitefully use you. We got some noise going on in the background. I don't know if we could mute somebody, Jeannie, but there's a lot of banging going on.
The only other person on is Dale.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe we could just get Dale to hold for just a second, and we'll just be right there. And so looking at this idea of maintaining in our minds the active presence of love, what that law speaks about is this: it isn't about morals. It isn't about what we do to the Creator, our neighbor, but it's about standing in the space that we create from. And when we create from a certain space, then if that space is connected to love, which is what that first law was speaking about, it didn't have to do with loving your neighbor. It wasn't something you did to your neighbor. It was a condition that you maintained in your own mind when you thought about neighbor. And so if you had a neighbor who showed up who could resonate some hostility or fear in you, if you kept that condition in your mind, your hostility and fear would heal. And your creative process would stay in the upgraded space, the highest space possible. And so that's kind of the biggest thing that's on my mind for today. And, of course, today being Aramaic Fridays, we'll find out where Dale is and what's happening in the part of the world you're in, Dale.
Did you want me to run some water and clank a glass again? I had my thumb over my thing. I was, like, rinsing a thing out, and I thought my thumb was going to cover the phone. But anyway.
Anyway.
See what other noises I can make. Yeah, I'm in Asheville in the weather's, I mean, I just spent, 4 days in Florida and then 2 days in South Carolina and back to Asheville, and the weather's just amazing. I think that's one of the benefits of all the travel is the microclimates. And, you know, what's funny, though, is even with all the travel, what we're talking about, you know, in terms of this is one of the things that I almost always end with, which is essentially love your neighbor as yourself, love anyone you think of as the breath of your life. It's exactly the same no matter what the climate is, no matter what the group of people is, no matter what their beliefs are, no matter what religion, no matter what borders. It's exactly the same everywhere you go. And I was sort of observing I didn't really watch the clip. I just kind of looked at a little blip about Pat Robertson. It was an interesting thing last night just to just observe him and to be in the open space with noticing how Pat was just literally vitriolically attacking not only gays and lesbians, but anyone who chose to support equality in marriage. And I thought it was an interesting, beautiful smoke and mirrors play, because the phrase that he used was that it was being forced down their throats. It was being forced down what he called believers' throats. And I was like, wow, that's an interesting thing to think that you're having something forced on you when that's exactly what's happening, really, probably in both directions in some ways. But interesting. It's all smoke and mirrors, and it applies. I mean, the thing about Yeshua's two commandments is you can lay it next to anything, or you can lay it in the middle of anything, and it applies in absolutely every situation, bar none, that in which you sort of criticize / attack, judge in another, you are guilty of practicing. Anyway, my little opening take on the whole thing. And of course, that applies in the Middle East as well, and that applies with ISIS, that applies with Canada right now, and anywhere that we choose to find it.
Well, seeing as how it points to maintaining a condition that is your source, maintaining awareness of your source as opposed to some sort of external event. You know, what I hear Yeshua saying with that is, whatever the external event is, be it good, bad, or indifferent, ugly, nasty, wonderful, delightful, our responsibility is to stay plugged in. Whatever it is we're working with. And if we disconnect, then we stop functioning as humans. And hostility and fear are the energies that disconnect us. Or, pardon me, I should say that we use to disconnect ourselves. So Yeshua was saying, in essence, what I hear him saying, and how does this fit for you, Dale, when you look at the Aramaic words, what he's saying is, you have to stay plugged into a proper power supply. And the proper power supply is love. It is a condition in your mind that when you maintain it, you will see everything differently, opposed to something you do to the creator, something you do to neighbor. And if you do that, then you will maintain your human life as opposed to, you know, love God, love neighbor as self. It's a way to maintain awareness of the true self, which is made of that stuff called love.
Mm. Of course, he said, you know, and what is it? It's, I believe it's Luke 10, where he said, first, of course, he was, it's interesting that in the three places in the Gospels, I've said this all the time, that in two cases, Yeshua says them. In one case, it's actually a scribe that says it back to him, because somebody kind of sort of metaphorically, possibly trying to back him into a corner, saying, well, what can I do to inherit eternal life? And Yeshua, you speak of this all the time in your work, he comes back and says, well, how's it written in the Mnemosa, which is actually the way that he asks that in Aramaic. He's like, how's it written in the Mnemosa? Although Mnemosa is technically a word of Greek origin. And he's like, how do you read it? And he said to him, love the Lord your God with your whole heart, all of the breath of your life, all of your napsha, and with all of your hilak. Hilak is such an interesting word because it's generally almost always in this case translated as strength. But what's interesting about hilak, or technically the lak sound at the end or the kuh sound, all that means is yours, your strength. But chaya doesn't mean just strength. When we think strength, you know, there's that phrase that I hear in a lot of modern Christianity. One of the phrases I hear is hold on to Jesus. And it's an interesting, strange, almost like a smoke and mirror retake on that, because that word chaya, the thing that's interesting about that is it means life. The word save is chaya. The word that was that we translate as salvation is chaya. I come to give you life. Chaya, eternal life, you know, chaya de alma. Chaya is also the word for the body temple, chai kla, kla, which means a gathering of something in one space. So you've got all of these different words that's basically the word life, conscious, vital life energy. And in this case, though, hilak, it's translated as strength. And the funny thing about that for me is that it doesn't equate with anything else that Yeshua ever said. He was never talking about holding on to anything. He was always speaking about being open. He was talking about being the open space. He was talking about being empty, not hold on with some human strength, but actually to bring all of your vital life essence into this experience, because the more of your vital life essence that you bring into the experience, the more of quote-unquote God that we bring into the experience, because that is our vital life essence, is what we call God. And it's actually in the opening up through our willingness and through what could be translated as virtue, but not in the Western sense that we think of virtue as like goody-goody. But what virtue actually means is an open or a clean vessel, something that, like as an example, if you're going to pour something into a cup, you clean that cup very well before you pour it in, just like the essence, the vital life of God being channeling through us, or should I say as us, and if we've got contaminated junk in the system, that's what's going to create through us. And if it's one of those things that I really feel that we're looking at it completely wrong, that it's not, and I'm not saying necessarily us, but the world in general in a lot of ways, because they're looking at something that you're holding on to with your own little sort of personal human strength. Hold on to Jesus, you know, with all of your might, when in actuality what it's really saying is to actually be open. And when you become that open space and you become that open channel, or you really, it's not even that you're a channel so much as you are conscious that, you know, the one is your vital life essence, then it's in that the true strength of God, of the cosmos, of whatever you would say, comes through us. And like you say, staying plugged in, being plugged into the creator. And it's beautiful because he goes on, and the guy continues and says, you know, with all your mind and anyone you think of as the breath of your life. But then Yeshua says, you've said this correctly, do this and you will live. And, of course, that word live is, what is it, techea, which, of course, is chea, which is the root of chaya, or chaya is the root of that. So he's literally saying, do this, and you will realize that you are life itself. You are the vital life essence. And the more that you do this, you stay in that singularity, the oneness with the source of everything, with the creator, with the life essence of everything that's real, that's absolute, that's, you know, calibrated, that's, you know, what you would say actuality, the more you do this, the more you shall live. And, of course, that's him fulfilling the promise, not of dying on a stick so that we don't have to do our work, but actually fulfilling the promise of coming to give us more life and giving it abundantly. Because we realize the only reason we don't have more life is not because it's not given, but it's because we're not living that. We're not being it because we have so many contaminants in the system that's dumbing it down, that's stopping and sort of choking off that vital life essence. So it's never about us holding on. It's about us being the open space so that we can realize that through that, you know, we are as strong as the strongest being ever created, because we realize that, you know, we are the one right here in time and space. And it's just amazing because he was constantly saying, it's not me, it's the one within me. You can do even greater things than I have, you know, just as much and if not greater. And we keep sort of missing that, throwing it off to the side and say, hold on to Jesus. And I'm sure he would probably, maybe he would have a grunt or something, like my little Shemaya somehow picked up a grunt from, I think she picked it up from Loretta. And it's like if Shemaya wants something now, about 3 and a half, and, you know, we say, well, no, or not right now, or try this instead, it's a, this little grunt. And I think, I wonder if Yeshua grunted when if he would actually see that, just this insane mockery supposedly in his name today of what they're really telling us to do today. So many forms of fundamentalist Christianity, of that extremism. Extremism, is that a word? They're basically saying, hold on to the ideology that I, myself, whether I be Pat Robertson or, you know, whatever, that's just the changing cast of characters. You know, hold on to my belief system, hold on to my BS, and hold on to that with all of your might. And if you don't hold on to the exact thing that I believe in, then I'm going to judge you, and I'm going to do everything that Yeshua said not to do. And I'll have absolutely no exemplification in my life of being calibrated with the Creator and being that open space. And in those cases, of course, I'll feel frustration and I'll feel like I'm breaking down because I'm using my own little sort of human, in quotes, strength. But he wasn't talking about our human strength. He was talking about letting that go to be the space that lets strength itself birth through you. What a different way of living, you know, and it's, wow. And the world's got it, you know, in so many ways. I believe 100%, you know, completely backwards, exactly 180 degrees opposite of what he was actually saying there. So I sort of went off on a little passionate thing there, but it's definitely, it's important, so.
I think it's of key importance, and, you know, the corollary when you mention that quote from Luke, I believe it's 10:20, and Yeshua, the man answers the question, how do I inherit eternal life? Yeshua says, well, spit back out of your mouth what I know you can spit out. I know you know it. You didn't need to ask me that. And then when he answers, he tells the man, yep, you got it. You spoke the truth. And then he tells the man what question his answer answers, and it's not the one about eternal life.
Yeah, says, absolutely.
As you said, do this and you shall live. And, of course, if you read that properly, if we're not doing that, does that mean we're dead? What's he saying to this man, you know, kind of in essence, sir, you're giving me this mental game about some afterlife somewhere, and you are already dead. You can parrot the words of the scriptures, but what have you done with them? Nothing. Therefore, you don't have a human life. And so he tells him the real question, and the real question is, how do I live? Oh, I keep the active presence of love in my mind when I think of the Creator, when I think of neighbor, when I think of self, and I let that flow through every cell of my being. Now I've got empowerment, and I've got a human life. Without it, dead, just a dead piece of flesh waiting to fall over and die.
You know, what else is interesting about that for me, too, is in this particular case, it's also where he says, the scribe says back, well, okay, who's my neighbor? And, he replies with the parable of the Good Samaritan. I did have an interesting experience. I mentioned a couple of times a few weeks ago on a radio interview, or the host actually had said to me that it doesn't matter. Why would it matter? Actually, he said it does not matter what something meant in Aramaic, because what Yeshua was doing was just quoting something from Hebrew scripture, and of course quoting that from the Hebrew scriptures, you know, from the Torah, the Hebrew Bible. He said it didn't matter what it meant in Aramaic because he was simply repeating what was already there. And it, the thing that was fascinating to me, as I explained, you know, neighbor, kerub, is anyone you think of, technically any object of your attention, including self. And he's like, well, that doesn't matter because in Hebrew it simply meant the person beside you, technically only a Jew. And I said, well, that's very interesting because I'm sure that's why he came with the parable of the Good Samaritan after that, because he was actually, you know, I'm pretty sure the whole point of putting the parable of the Good Samaritan out there is to let people know that, hey, guess what? You know, just because we've gone through Lord knows how long we have thinking that it's only another Jew that's our neighbor, guess what? There's actually a lot more to this. And, you know, people today think of, when they think of Samaritan, you know, they're basically, it's like without even realizing what it really means on a lot of levels, they're basically thinking that, you know, a good Samaritan is a do-gooder. And it's not quite that, because I've said this on here before, that Samaritans were, along with Aramaic speakers, were often called the swines or the pigs or what we would call the dregs of humanity now. And what happened was, here's a Jew on the side of the road, and he's battered and bruised, and he's very sick and weak, and he's hungry, and he's passed up by Jew after Jew after Jew, yet it was a Samaritan that stopped, one of the pigs, the swine, the people who were so supposedly hated by the Jews, who stopped to nurse this Jew's wounds and to get him a place to stay for the night and get some food in his belly. And if we could just get that, it's not about another Jew. It's not about someone else that believes in your BS. This is about anyone and everyone, including yourself. If we could just crack through that, just crack through that shell. And I thought it was funny, too, because when I said that on the radio show, he immediately was like, okay, we got to go to commercial. So he just totally stopped it. And then it was even more funny because when we went to the little break, he was doing all of his best efforts to change the subject so that we wouldn't go back out on air, that for me to keep talking about that, you know, that he was pulling me toward, I can't remember what it was. I think it was toward the Lord's Prayer or something like that, trying to change the subject completely, you know, because I think he probably sensed on some level that we would go back and I would be, you know, seeking to make sure that that was as clear as I could get it. But interesting experience, though.
Well, I don't know, Dale, if I've ever shared with you the story that Dan, I mean, one of my favorite stories that Dan would tell about the translation work on the Horus was around the word neighbor. And Marc Schumann, who Dan used to describe as being older than God, would be the equivalent of the Pope of the Church of the East. And when, you know, there were 25 translators working on this translation work, and their translation had to be consistent before it was put into the laboratory, the classroom, to be tested. And there was one very well-respected Aramaicist, a guy named John Shapley. And when John kept coming back with the word neighbor being somebody who was physically near to you, and the other translators were, no, this is a mental word, it's anyone mentally near to you. If you think about someone, they are your neighbor. So he goes to Chicago and he sits down with Marc Schumann and says, you know, what's going on here? And I'll always remember, you know, the way that Dan waved his arm, mimicking Marc Schumann. And Marc Schumann says, oh, I know what's gotten Shapley confused. He's reading those new dictionaries they wrote in the 6th century. And he went on to explain, when the generals changed the meaning of the word neighbor so that they could justify doing war and killing people. But clearly, the word in Aramaic, kerub, is the person that you think about. And so anyone that you think about, and when you look at the genius of this piece of input, it isn't about something you do to that kerub, to that neighbor. If you face your most terrible, awful, evil, you know, whatever you want to call them, enemy, that's the most important person in the world for you to maintain that condition of love in your mind when you're in their presence. Because with that condition of love in your mind, you have access to literally the genius and the mind of the universe, and you will have the best flexibility and the best safety that you could possibly have by being in that mind rather than the mind of your body with all of it. As you said earlier, it's, you know, the things that it taints the energy system with. So as we stay connected to that active presence of love, again, it's not about what we do to our neighbor, what we do to the creator, but it's how we maintain our human lives. And there's where our genius is. You know, and Jeannie, when we opened the Why Is This Happening to Me Again workshop, and she asked the question, you know, how many have ever done something they regret, and asked people to identify what they were feeling when they did what they regretted, 100% of the time, the answer comes back as some variation on the theme of hostility or fear. If we lose the condition of love in our minds, we lose it to hostility or fear. And when hostility or fear is active, intelligence gone, people do what they regret. So what Yeshua is saying is, hey, if there's anybody that you might be on the edge, you know, it's kind of an example would be, if there's anybody that you could be on the edge of regret with, here's what's most important. You maintain your connection to love, and you will have the best, most genius mind possible instead of falling into doing what you regret. It's about the quality of the energy with which we create. It's not about what we're doing to our neighbor or to the creator or to ourselves. Maintaining self, maintaining connection to human life is the key there. And of course, when you talk about the whole idea of the expression coming through, when you think about physiology as an instrument, we are designed to be reflections and instruments that capture the active presence of love and express it in the world. That's what we're designed for. If our instrument is filled with hostility or fear, it's kind of like, you know, there's the Boston Pop Symphony playing Brahms, you know, most complex, beautiful concerto. And we're tuning into it on a $10 transistor radio. We're listening to Brahms, you know, it's pretty rough. But we're listening to Brahms. And that's the person who lives in hostility or fear. There's some shadow of human life that comes through, but it's like the $10 transistor radio. As somebody starts to do their work and upgrades their instrument through forgiveness by removing the hostility or fear, the ultimate, you know, way to listen to Brahms is on that $100,000 sound system over there, not on the $10 transistor radio. And each of us was given an instrument, a body-mind unit, of absolutely equal quality. And I think this is the more important point on the equality rather than, you know, the other conversations about, you know, the way we're distracted in the world today. But the real equality is that we're all given an instrument, but if our experiences and if our genetics have filled that instrument with hostility and fear, then we fall all over ourselves. We create an insane life in an insane world. And, of course, we proclaim ourselves to be innocent victims. No, this isn't my fault. Look, they did this to me. Well, you'll notice, though, that the overload and what's going on inside of you is going on inside of you, and it's your purification process. It's your opportunity to clean your instrument up so that you can create something different. Again, that first law is about maintaining a source and supply of high-level, clean, clear, creative energy with which to create your life. If your instrument's filled with hostility, fear, rage, guilt, grief, pain, drama, and trauma, and how can you tell if it is? You feel it. If you're feeling it, then, you know, you're playing life through a $10 transistor and going, but I hear Brahms back there. Why am I not playing it properly? It's because you're tainting it with what's in your instrument, and you will be confronted with what's in your instrument, and then you'll get the opportunity to learn forgiveness. And forgiveness isn't about letting somebody else off the hook because your instrument is playing hostility, fear, grief, rage, et cetera, et cetera. Forgiveness is how you go in and delete literally your very capacity for those things. And then when you get your instrument upgraded to the equivalent of that $100,000 stereo system, man, will Brahms sound good to you. Everything you look at, everything you touch, everything you taste will be sweet. Even what yesterday was bitter, because by going through an instrument connected to love, it now becomes infused with the perfume of the gods. Any thoughts on that, Dale? Did we lose you, Dale? Jeannie?
We did lose him. So,
Well,
there he is.
Hello.
Back on.
Hi.
He is back on, and Dr. Tim is on, and we do have several hands up.
Let's say a quick hello to Dr. Tim and see if he's got anything to add. Do you have anything to add to that, Dale?
Just really quick. First, I somehow got dropped in the middle. I don't know what happened. I just wanted to, before we got into the calls, I just wanted to read that parable really quickly. It's only it's about five lines. Because I think it's sort of, so this is, he goes, of course, so who's my neighbor? Yeshua said to him, a certain man had gone down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and robbers fell upon him and stripped him and beat him and left him while barely leaving any life within him. And then they left. And it so happened that a certain priest was going down the road and saw him and passed right by. Likewise, a Levite came and arrived at the place and saw him and passed right by. But a Samaritan man, while he was journeying, came where he was and saw him and had compassion upon him. When he approached and bandaged his wounds and poured wine and oil upon him, he put him on his donkey and brought him to an inn and took care of him. And on the dawn of that day, he departed and gave 2 denarii to the innkeeper and said to him, take care of him, and if he requires anything more, when I return, I will give it to you. Who, therefore, from these three seems to you to be a neighbor to him, and who fell into the hands of the bandits? And the man said, obviously it was him who had compassion on him. Yeshua said to him, go and do likewise. That's pretty clear to me.
Pretty clear. And, of course, one's got to have a capacity for the human attribute of compassion and being love to be able to have that to hand to somebody. Somebody who's in their hostility and fear-based mind, and I love Yeshua's definition of the Pharisee when he's invited to lunch with the Pharisee and he doesn't wash his hands and the Pharisee's shocked. And Yeshua says and defines for him what his mind is and what a Pharisee is, and he says, for you keep the outside of the cup and the platter clean. In other words, it looks like you got a $100,000 stereo system. Your inward parts are filled with, the Greeks translate it as ravening and wickedness, it's hostility and fear. He says your inward parts are filled with that. In other words, inside you're a $10 transistor, outside you're trying to look like a $100,000 stereo system. Get to work and upgrade your instruments so that you too can have compassion and be neighbor to everyone that you communicate with, everyone that you come upon.
I'll also say too that the word in Luke 10, is it 33, when he says compassion, the man had compassion, that word's rachma, by the way, just to say.
Mm-hmm.
Nice to know, huh?
First law, active presence of love. There it is. Got to have a human life before you can have a human life. And having a body is not a human life by any stretch of the imagination. If it's filled with hostility or fear, the instrument's pretty tainted.
It's watzrakham, which is rachma. So it's just a form of it. That's it.
Yep.
Nice. Beautiful.
Yeah, cool. Let's say hello to Dr. Tim.
Hello there. Hi, Dale. Hi, Mike. Michael,
Hello.
The call is fabulous, and I just want to defer to the callers to see if we can get some other calls for Dale on Aramaic Friday, as we were talking about earlier. The more different perspectives and questions we get, the better it is.
For sure. So, Jeannie, you got a hand up?
I actually have three hands up, and the first one is area code 517. You're on the air. Who do we have and where are you calling from?
This is Harry. Harry.
Hi, Harry.
Young man. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. Everybody thinks I'm crazy because they think I'm God. And I know them guys because I've been guys for ever since 1995.
Right. Can we answer a question for you?
Huh?
Can we answer a question for you, sir?
Sure.
What's the question?
What's the question? I love you.
I accept. Thank you. All right.
You're
we hold the space for you, too.
Okay. I love you.
Okay. All right. Have a blessed day. Thanks for staying with me. Okay, Jeannie?
The next one. Next one's area code 910. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I have a question about the Aramaic word, and I'll spell it M-A-P-H-S-H-A. There are those of us in Wilmington, North Carolina, who are doing the laws of living, and this has come up in our reading, and because there's only a paragraph about it, I was wondering if maybe Dale and Michael could elaborate.
So it sounds like Nopsha to me.
Yes, I think that's it.
Okay. I'd say let Michael run with that, and then I can...
M?
Yeah, I think it's N-A-P-H, or what is it? What would it be in English? N-A-P-H-S-H-A, Nopsha, so...
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Go for it. Yes. No, the funny thing about Nopsha is that it's it's a word. It's one of the most difficult. If I could pick five words that are most difficult to get from Aramaic into English, that would be one of the five. It might even be in the top three. Now, colloquially, usually, generally, when that's used in a lot of Aramaic translations going into another language, especially into English, it's usually just left there. You'll usually just see the word Nopsha there because it's so difficult to translate. Sometimes you'll see breath of life, but that's only like a slight bit of nuance of it. That's not the whole thing. I think probably the best way I've ever heard it explained comes from Michael's mouth. So I'd like to turn it over to him because I love, especially coming, and you must – the best explanation I've ever seen, and I guess it might be what you're referring to in your reading, is the Kaboris Enlightenment. It's like the one that Michael sells, you know, the Kaboris Enlightenment publication. That's the most concise and sort of nuanced definition I've ever, or at least description, I've ever seen of Nopsha. It's funny that it's one of those words that, honestly, when I was really deep into the language itself, a lot of people skated over and had no idea what they were even looking at. So they just kind of went on to the next words. And that's why I believe that the Kaborik's Codex Foundation and what came through with the Archdeacon and Deacon and Dan McDougald and what Michael's doing, I thank God for that, because if not for that, I don't know that a lot of modern people would even think about the word. So I'd love to sort of defer to Michael and hear what he's got to express about it. And if I feel like there's some nuance to pop in there, I'll throw something in too.
Cool. Well, my take would be that that's what we've been talking about for the whole show. We started out, you know, the thought that was most on my mind, and maybe I was picking up on your thought from Wilmington when it was just so focused into this idea of the first law, which is, you know, maintaining this gateway, this condition in your mind, that's what lets Nopsha enter into your body. And so I think a good substitute word there in English would be being. It's who we are. And Rachma, the first law, Yeshua is saying, maintain your human life, maintain your Nopsha. And the way you do that is by keeping this gateway, this portal in the frontal lobes of the brain, that was called Rachma, active in you. And if it is, then your Nopsha, your being, your intelligence, your genius, your wisdom is going to show up and run your life. And it'll be the highest advisor and advice and intelligence in mind you could possibly have. And that is to maintain your human beingness. That's what will upgrade your instrument, heal everything that's in you. And what Yeshua says is that a house divided against its own Nopsha cannot stand. When hostility and fear come in, they obliterate our Nopsha. They obliterate the human being. What, you know, probably the best definition is the experiential definition we ask people to go into when we say, have you ever held a newborn? Have you, our caller, I didn't catch your name. Have you ever held a newborn child?
Oh, many times.
So if you were to go back and, you know, take one of those really high moments of holding one of those newborns, and you were to put the essence of that newborn into a single word, what would that word be?
Obviously, love, pure, wholeness.
Now say the word noxia.
Noxia.
Yeah, that's it. That's the definition. That's what we're experiencing when we hold the newborn. And if we are divided against that, and we are divided against that by holding in this instrument some form of hostility and fear, and it shuts the gateway down and cuts us off from our nafsha. And when we are cut off from our nafsha, we will be destroyed. And we won't be destroyed by anybody outside of us that's upset because we've cut ourselves off. We'll be destroyed because we are separated from the source of our very lives. And so Yeshua, as opposed to setting us upon some sort of a religious journey, was setting us on the journey back to experiencing ourselves as this human beingness. And, you know, when Dale brought the example of the Samaritan up, this is the person who expressed his nafsha toward this person who was not of his own sect. And if anybody walked by him, it should have been the Samaritan. But the Samaritan had contact with his nafsha. He had human life in him. The others who lived in their intellects about their religions and their dogmas and their doctrines, the way most people in the world do today, have no real interest in love. If you threaten their doctrine, their dogma, they'll cut your head off or they'll go to war with you and shoot you. Because there's no human life in them. There's no nafsha there. Oh, there's a set of rules that you're nice to your family and you do, but... you know, if you're capable of killing, then you're separated from your nafsha. And so Yeshua came to reconnect us to that awesome, direct connected source of love, and then to teach us how to upgrade our instrument so that anything that separated us from that, we were able to forgive. And forgiveness means I'm able to reach into my instrument and remove that which separates me from my nafsha and leads to my downfall. Does that fit? Does that make sense for your question?
Yes. Thank you.
Absolutely.
I would also,
delighted, Jesse. Thank you. Go ahead, Dale.
I was just going to say that generally, like what we're used to in Christianity, like in the King James Bible, what eventually got its way into English, it was usually when you would see the word self or soul or occasionally life, it would end up sort of in the way that we grew up. Sometimes life was chaya, but sometimes it was nafsha, but it was usually self or soul is what it was translated as in sort of the standard Christian teachings in the West. So, you know, that barely scratches the surface. Michael got, you know, and I would say, get your hands on that Kaboris Enlightenment publication if you don't already have it and just reread it. It's kind of like A Course in Miracles. You don't just read and go, oh my God, that's it. The world is amazing. Maybe that may happen.
Yeah.
That's happened.
Right.
That's great. But read it and read it and read it and keep breathing. Keep your breath moving. Notice any place where you may sort of catch or start to sort of go almost like a question mark forms above your head, not so much like as you're open, but like, oh, that doesn't make sense or something, then stop there and breathe your way through it and keep reading and be gentle in yourself and be open. And I'll tell you that what you're feeling is actually that entrance or that expansion of that nafsha through you right then. And anything you put in the way of that, of, you know, an old belief system not allowing that to be open and flowing, then your nafsha is not going to be open and flowing. It's going to be sort of more restricted and, you know, kind of hunkered down in a way. So realize that the experience you feel when you go, oh, whoa, I get it now, that's a nafsha experience of that opening of the soul, if you will, which it's something that's not a thing so much as it's that direct experience of, you know, you being in that open flow. It's everything we've been talking about today. It almost couldn't be more perfectly placed, your question on this particular show. So Just be open.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah. And Dale, you remind me of something else that fits in very well here, because ultimately what the work is about is processing everything that reduces us from the $100,000 stereo system we're designed to be down to the $10 transistor radio. And our expression is, you know, pharisaical in that case. And in the Eastern Aramaic lands, if you were standing in front of a speaker and you were sitting there bright and bushy-tailed and bright-eyed, and all of a sudden your eyelids got heavy, it was like somebody was putting anchors on your eyelids, and your eyes start to fall, and your head starts to nod, and you're gone, that was a compliment to an Aramaic speaker, because what it was saying is, you've hit the nail on the head so deeply that you are accessing, and I am now processing my unconsciousness. So it was actually a compliment for someone to check out like that, or to fall into that processing of unconsciousness, and that's just part of the healing process. So if you ever find yourself, Patsy, while you're in the study and you're working with it, you know, I'm sitting reading something, and I'm bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and all of a sudden I read a sentence and my head wants to go plunk. That's your next piece of gold right there. That's your next piece of processing work to do. You sound with that laugh like you've been there and done that when you've had that experience.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Delighted, young lady. We'll look forward to seeing you in a few weeks. We'll be there and get to play with the whole the Laws of Living class. And I hear it's just going awesomely well.
It is. I highly recommend it. Thank you.
All right. Blessing. Thank you. All right. Very cool. Great question. Just, it could, as you say, Dale, it couldn't have been more perfectly placed.
Yeah, it was right on. Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And if I remember correctly, if you read in the Enlightenment book, the definition of that word is, I don't even remember now, 2 pages or something, which you have to spend with it. Ruka Dikuja, 3 pages to get a sense of it.
Yeah, the Ruka one is amazing, especially when you know, when it's getting into the nuclear forces and cosmic expansion. It's and that's just, you know, just the thought that we were raised with like a Holy Ghost, boo, that was like standing around that corner that like scares you or something. I mean, Holy Ghost, what the dumbing down of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit as being people, you know, awful. But
all right, Jeannie, do we have another caller with an Aramaic question?
We have area code 901. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. This is Vernie in Memphis. I'm thoroughly
enjoying. Hey, you're welcome.
Thank you. I've written down probably about 15 questions, which cannot all be answered today. But the latest thing I realize is you're talking about discussing Naksha. You know, I've listened to you many times on the Naksha, but I'm sitting here and I'm breathing, you know, keeping myself breathing, and all of a sudden I started yawning, and it's the yawns that I get when I point breathing, and they're very, very hard yawns. But I know I've looked from past experience that when I do that type of yawning, that something is clearing out, although I have no idea why. So whatever the discussion has triggered has been very interesting to find out. But I did have an Aramaic question that triggered one of the things. And these are words. I know throughout, read the King James Version and such, the word Lord is used in many, many different ways, sometimes capitalized, sometimes not capitalized and such. So my question is, can you give me some insight on the Aramaic understanding of that word that is used in so many places, sometimes with an angry Lord or with a benevolent one and such like that?
I definitely could.
Okay.
Well, first of all, although I'm sure it's not foolproof, I'm sure there's probably some mistakes there, but generally, if it's not capitalized, the word is generally what we would know of in English is M-A-R-A, Mara, Mara is the way it sounds, or Mari is the other way it would sound. That would mean basically, that was kind of like a way of saying, sort of like the way we did in the West for a while, saying basically, you hear my lady or my lord. It was kind of just a term of endearment, like a politeness. That would be like a small lord, although that could also be a lord as in a what would be called a bread giver, which would be somebody who, you know, owns the land and the peons work for him, aptly named. Kind of like a power person kind of a thing. Now, when you get to capital L, that word is Maria, actually, Maria in Aramaic, which people think it's Italian or Latin, and it's both, but yet that comes from Aramaic, Maria. Now, Mar is actually a word that means coming from strength, coming from strength, which is very interesting. And what Maria means is one who exudes or radiates a feminine light from a place of strength. Now, what feminine light means is that, you know, if you turn on a light bulb or you look at the sun, that's a masculine light. When you're seeing that directly, it's very sharp, it's very obvious. That would be a masculine light. A feminine light is not so much seen as much as it's sensed. You know, like we've been talking about that, the baby in the first 20 minutes of life. That's Maria. That would be what Lord meant in that sense. Now, it gets problematic, though, especially in what we would call the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, because there's so many places where people's own personal sort of inner dynamics or issues or belief systems and ideologies are burning up in the presence of that light of what we would call the Lord, you know, God, the light of God. But what happened for just a long time, and it's all over, especially the Old Testament, it's a little bit in the New Testament, people were mistaking their own burning as that God is somehow vengeful or will burn you or something to that effect. But the truth is that there's no such thing as the fire of hell. There's only the light of God. And what happens is when we, as an example, here as a culture, we're asking for more light, higher consciousness, with that comes greater responsibility. And having a greater light and greater, you know, with our vibration moving faster, there's more things we could see that we couldn't see before. So as the light expands through us, napsha, the breath of life, the light of God, the Lord expands through us. Lord's just a bad word. It's actually a medieval term from England that was a leftover term from feudalism. It, like I said, it was the guy that owned the land. So it's just a bad word to use. But Maria, when the presence of or the light of God expands in our life, if there's anything that blocks that light, it's exactly what Michael and I have been saying for the whole show, anything that's any residue in the system that blocks that light, that residue has to burn up. And that's why Michael always says willingness is the cosmic grease. Now, since the residues and those beliefs that are in us have to burn, and yet that's the way we've more often than not related with the world as ourselves is through those beliefs rather than from that light, it feels like we're dying, and it may feel on some level like we're suffering. So what happens is that suffering, which is the resistance of allowing the light of God to move through us and allowing those sort of untruths to burn up in that light, when we resist the process and we try to push back, then we start suffering, and then it feels like pain. And then we call that pain whatever, you know, a vengeful God or something like that. But the analogy that I give, though, in terms of Lord, and where the misperception comes from is in ancient times, go back 2,000 years, you know, as far back as who knows how many tens of thousands of years back, they likened the light of the sun to the light of God, just as a metaphor. And the sun was called the only begotten in Coptic, in Sumerian, in Phoenician, in Akkadian, in all these different languages and philosophies. And one of the examples they would use is what happens when you get closer to the light of the sun? You what? You burn. And then the other side of that for the Gnostics was what happens when the light of God emerges, or what happens when you get closer to the light of God? You burn. And the reason that we burn is because there's still something in us that believes that it's not that light. And when someone was called Lord, that was a way of saying you've burned away your veils to such an extent that I see your light more than your shadow. And it was a way of saying you exude that natural feminine light of God, of the cosmos, whatever you want to say. And that was what Lord meant in that sort of more deeply spiritual sense. And the ones who, you know, that all those ideologies that God is going to get you, a vengeful God, all that meant was nothing can come into the place of that one light except that one light. So if you go in carrying junk, beliefs and ideologies and religions and whatever it may be, that stuff's going to have to burn up. And in that burning, you may feel like you're suffering. And that's why people would call God vengeful, but there's no vengeance in that. It's just our unwillingness to let go and be in that light, to be who we already are. So hopefully that sort of gets it into a nutshell.
Very nice.
And Dale, you know, where Yeshua says, I am the light of the world, what he's saying is, I'm holding such a powerful space of that active love, your eyelids are going to get heavy and you're going to burn off what you need to burn off. And once you've burned it off, and he only changes the pronoun, he changes nothing else in the sentence, he says, you are the light of the world. Each one of us is designed to be the light of the world, but we've got to go through the fire first. We've got to burn off what we're in resistance to looking at, feeling, and dealing with, and what we're blaming on everybody else, what we turn and create all kinds of confusion in front of us so that we don't have to look at it. Oh, this is your fault. You did this to me. The reason I'm feeling this is all yours. You just shut up. You just get out of my way. Don't say another word. Don't show me what I don't want to look at. And that's someone who is trying to avoid the light. And light is an equivalent of truth. In blockage of truth, we keep that heaviness, that pain, that trauma. And that's all self-induced, as you say. There's no punishment in the Creator. All the Creator's going to do is turn up the light. And if there's resistance in us, then there's going to be heat. And if we let it go, if we soften and forgive, we can directly let it go without having to go through that drama and that trauma. So we join in every person who listens and does their work in being the light of the world.
Thank you.
Wow, cool. Beautiful question.
Thank you.
Today.
A great question, Bernie. This is awesome. We've got about 2 minutes left. Do we have a two-minute commentary? Dale, you have anything to share? Bernie, do you have another question? Tim? Michael?
Oh, the only thing I would say is it might look on some levels like the stuff is hitting the fan, and what's happening is the light is increasing. Our awareness is increasing. We're vibrating faster. And with that comes a greater responsibility to live the very things that we're mouthing, to be the light that we claim that we are. And I think so many of us that are holding that light, that are not even really holding that light, but are allowing that light to express, I think we're doing a great job and in not buying in to these excesses of just the insanities of the world. I think we're doing great. We just got to keep at it and keep going and I'm ready for it. You know, I'm ready for the transitions. I just read today as an example that Italy is going to be considering equality in marriage. So a lot of people seem to be standing there waiting for the U.S. Let's go. Let's do it. Let's move forward. Let's actually live it. You know, we're doing a great job, I think.
All right. Well, we're down to the last few seconds. If you want to access Dale's schedule and materials, go to DaleAllenHoffman.com. And, of course, whyagain.org. We'll give you our schedule. We're here in Lansing tonight, and tomorrow's Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing. Sunday at Unity of Greater Lansing. Tonight we're at Renaissance Unity, but the other Unity of Greater Lansing will be there Sunday afternoon doing Cody Payne's Unity Payne's. All these flyers are on the website. Monday night is Fellowship for Today. What is the World from A Course in Miracles will be the lesson from 7 until 9. And then the next night, Tuesday, 7 to 9:30, we'll be at the IM Center on the south side of town. So come and join us. And if you're ready to really crank your work up, we'll begin on the 31st of October, 9-day codependence to unity penance, about an hour from here. We have a beautiful facility, residential intensive workshop. Come and join us for that, starting the 31st through the 8th of November. So we're delighted that you're here to share with us, and we invite you to bring a stranger to the show tomorrow and give the world the best gift you can possibly give, and that is the best year yet of your eternal life. Blessings.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife, Jeannie, who present the internal Aramaic process of forgiveness. Michael and Jeannie are here every Monday through Friday on Earth Angels Radio. For more on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.whyagain.com. That's www.whyagain.com.